From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I am Kizmiche Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs, and this week I sit down with Dr. Charlaine Hailing Williams to discuss protecting our mental health in the age of increased activism. But next, a message from Mark H. Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. In the 24-year history of the United States, four African-American men have presided as chief executive officers of a state or commonwealth. Only two were elected in their own right, Deval Patrick of Massachusetts in 2006 and Douglas Wilder of Virginia in 1989. David Paterson of New York was elevated to the office of governor upon the resignation of Eliot Spitzer in 2008. Before Wilder's election in 1989, we have to go all the way back to 1872 to find another African-American governor. P.B.S. Pinchback served as governor of my home state of Louisiana for 6 weeks while an impeachment case against John McErney was tried. Given this history, it is nothing short of remarkable that this year there are three African-American major party nominees for governor, each of whom stand to become the first Black governor of his or her state. If elected, Stacey Abrams would not only be the first Black governor of Georgia, she would be the first Black woman governor anywhere in the United States. No stranger to the title first, she was the first Black valedictorian in memory at her DeKalb County High School, and she was the first woman and the first person of color ever to hold the office of minority leader in the Georgia State House. Andrew Gillum, a nominee for Florida governor, also showed early signs of promise. Selected by the Gainesville Sun newspaper as a person of the year upon his graduation from high school, at only 23 and still an undergraduate student at Florida A&M, he was the youngest person ever elected to the Tallahassee City Commission. Years later, he became mayor of Tallahassee at the age of 35. Ben Jealous, a candidate for Maryland governor, is a familiar face to the Urban League movement. During his 5 years as president of the NAACP, the youngest person ever to serve in that office, we work side by side on issues of racial justice and civil rights. Like me, he's the son of two fierce civil rights activists. Ben Jealous was born into the movement. His Black mother, Ann, faced taunts and threats as one of a handful of Black students to desegregate Baltimore's Western High in 1955. His white father, Fred, participated in sit-ins to desegregate Baltimore's lunch counters. These three candidates have compiled a stunning record of achievement, and they stand now as worthy role models for a new generation of activists and leaders. While we do not endorse candidates, we encourage everyone to get out and vote. This is Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment.
Dr. Hailing Williams, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So for many of us who are activists, advocates, media and communications professionals, those of us who work in the civil rights and public policy space, our professional lives changed quite dramatically. And in some cases, our personal lives changed quite dramatically also and became more stressful since the election of 45. Our civil and human rights seem to be under attack with attempts to roll back key policies, shut down borders, stack judicial benches, et cetera. There's been an increase in narratives about distrusting the media and fake news. For people who work in this space, we not only felt the effects of this distrust, but we were also labeled as propagandists in our defense of facts and trying to combat harmful policy proposals. As a result, many of us are fatigued. So my initial question is, how do you define or describe what we're experiencing, and is there a clinical term for it?
So this is an exciting opportunity to discuss overall wellness, right? So there are a ton of paradigm shifts that are taking place because that which we thought and considered normal, boundaries that we thought could not be crossed, things that we held near and dear about our country, who we are as professionals, who we are as people, basic human rights, as you said, are all called into question. But what does that really cause for each of us individually? And so personally, it really causes us to have this paradigm shift or a flip of the switch around who am I? What do I need to do to maintain my wellness? Perhaps mental health should be viewed as such, not as mental illness, but more so as an act of resistance and an act of self-care and an act of we all should so that we can continue to function and do what's necessary and required in a climate such as this. So while I have and maintain empathy for all of us who are enduring, all of us who are change agents and liberators and revolutionaries in our own rights and in our own respective fields and disciplines, I also find it such an awesome opportunity to ask the key question around what this shift means for each of us. What does it mean for me? How do I have to look at this? Because the way that we look at things, the frame or the lens through which we see all challenges really predicts our long-term success and our overall wellness. So if I view this current state of being or state of affairs as the opportunity of my life to change history for the better for folks as it relates to mental health and wellness as a psychologist. As a Black psychologist, I can use this opportunity to build a platform to discuss the importance of the way that we think, act, and feel, predicting all other things in our lives versus doom and gloom and it begetting some form of disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It will sustain me in ways that it wouldn't otherwise, right? So that's a protective barrier. If we look at being in communications as having this platform to speak truth to power in a way that the masses are validated in their discomfort, to say, you're not off the mark, they're off the mark. You're not wrong. Your eyes and ears are not deceiving you. I'm going to illustrate exactly what's happening, exactly why it's happening, what the effects are of these things that are happening, and what we can do about it, then that will empower you, all of us, in such a way that we feel that we have our fingers on the pulse of what's necessary. And when we frame it as such, as this being what life is about, this being what it means to be in the midst of a revolution, the problem comes up when you sort of reject that and you want to stay in this place of comfort. And the term, to answer your question, is really cognitive dissonance, right? When your beliefs and attitudes and actions are misaligned with reality,
mm-hmm.
which gets really close to confusion, which gets really close to insanity.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're talking about illness and not wellness. And so all of those things are really what's beneath this.
So how do you develop that protective barrier that you talk about then? For those who work in this space and get up each morning to fight the fight, I mean, there is a level of it that is stressful and that can wear you down. How do you, in a sense, develop a higher tolerance for this kind of stress, if that should even be a goal?
Definitely. So, you know, what you're getting at is, and we've toyed around with the word, you know, being woke,
mm-hmm.
Which is essentially elevating our consciousness, because there is a reality that must be underscored, that it becomes very comfortable for us, particularly people in places of privilege, the middle class and above, to kind of put these blinders on and to rest on our laurels a bit. And so when you began to awaken, and especially when it feels like someone sort of woke you up with a bucket of cold water, it becomes extremely jarring and stressful, and it's very in your face, and there's nowhere you can put it, and so on and so forth. So then there are things, obviously, that we can do, and we can do what we should have been doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So things like finding things that bring you joy, bring you peace, meditation, I would highly recommend that most everyone at some point in their lives engage in therapy, in, you know, traditional counseling, which is really not the core treatment for mental illness. That's really the treatment for mental wellness, to sit across from someone and be able to discuss who you are, where you've been, where you'd like to go, what things are sort of bringing up strife in your life, how you can balance it all, and having a non-judgmental, skilled listener help you create a roadmap for success is life-changing. And so that is something that you can do. I encourage all of us to do. Another thing we can do is unplug, have some protected time. Every day, all day, we cannot overly consume news, social media, have our time with our friends and family revolve around the stress that's happening around us. There has to be a bubble in which we can all recharge, mm-hmm. because exhaustion begins to really cause delirium. And then we're just like running around and we don't have a beginning or an end and we can't shut down and shut it off and you're not resting well. And so you're exhausted and delirious. And that's obviously a recipe for disaster. And so meditation, yoga, counseling and therapy, quality time with friends and family, things that bring us joy, painting, riding a bike, so on. It sounds like, oh, obviously, but we'll go on and it'll be like 2 weeks since you've done things that really allow you to unplug. Mm-hmm. Even if that's just like, I like to garden. I like to go to the library and just find a book to check out. Those types of things are really important. And it says, I'm going to maintain my sanity, mm-hmm. so that I can be who I need to be to keep fighting this fight.
So those things that you describe, is that considered practicing good mental health and self-care? How do you define mental health and self-care?
Certainly. So I was saying it allows us to be. And so this question that I have been really asking rhetorically is, what does it mean to be well? Mm-hmm. And I'll sign my emails and everything with be well. And I talk about being well. How do we maintain our wellness? That is the goal and really of life. What's at the core of that, though? At the core of being well is balance. And that's really, in my opinion, every person's chief goal in life, to achieve balance. Mm-hmm. We talk about it anecdotally, but everything revolves quite often around work-life balance. It revolves around balancing our time with our friends and family, balancing our, you know, budgets, balancing everything that you balance. And when you find that place where you have what you need on the left and what you need on the right to be appropriately centered, then you are in a place of being well. And when one thing gets out of balance and we're doing too much of the left and not enough of the right, then we are off center, off balance, and challenges come. The problem has really come in because we've become masterful at masking that. And it becomes almost celebrated and normal to see us talking about or being at work 11, 12, 15 yeah. hours a day, talking about being, you know, out at every function doing this work and so on and so forth. And very rarely does anyone say, hey, when's the last time you kind of unplugged? How do we really look at those folks who say, I have a hard stop? No, I'm not going to be able to do that because I need to balance, because I need to do some self-care. That rarely comes up in the conversation. And so that's really the goal or the task at hand, to achieve balance in our lives toward the goal of being well.
Mm-hmm. For people who don't work as activists, advocates, media professionals, just in the civil rights space, but they follow the news and they follow what's the changing climate in our country and society. What do they do when their desire to be well-informed is at odds with maintaining their sanity and mental health? Would the everyday person prioritize self-care in the same way as those who work in this space?
Certainly, and maybe even more so, because when we think about it, when you work in the policy, media, communications, most of the things in and around Washington or elsewhere that promote the needs of the people, when you're kind of on the front lines in that way, in whatever role, you are likely to be much more aware of the issues in a way that is your job, your main function on a daily basis. Now, for your school teacher, your medical doctor, your landscape architect, psychologist even, it could be easier to have your finger a little bit less on the pulse, right? However, if at all you're socially conscious, you can't help but be motivated or respond or feel the need to respond to this call to action, because that's really what's happening. We're all being forced to answer the question, when the movement comes, when the revolution comes, what side will I be on? What will I do? What will my role in history be? Because we've had the quote-unquote luxury in this generation of talking about civil rights as an issue of the 60s, right? And so now here we are in 2018 in the fight of the generation to really preserve that which is essential and create that which is necessary for ourselves, our children, and their children. So for all of us, it's going to be required to ask, what will I do? What am I doing? Who am I? Am I all that I can be, and am I all that I should be? And there's really no space for people to ride the fence. And that's uncomfortable, because if I have become comfortable in my complacency, if I have my little house and my little family and my safe, cushy job, and it doesn't really happen to me, and then I'm in Sanford, Florida, and Trayvon Martin is killed, or I'm in Ferguson, Missouri, and Mike Brown is killed, or in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, my hometown, and Alton Sterling is killed, it's in my face now. And it doesn't matter if I'm a school teacher or a psychologist or I work, you know, in a library. I feel like I have to do something. And if I don't do something, what does that say about me? And so I'm watching it on the news, and every time I'm watching it on the news or reading it in the newspaper or looking online, or I'm watching other people act and do. And if I'm not, then that's even more stressful, because I have to ask myself why. Because I always said, if given the opportunity, I would be on the front lines. I wouldn't let them do that to my community. I wouldn't let them do that to Black boys and men and you know, little girls who look like me. They wouldn't get to, you know, strip away women's rights. Not on my watch. And then it's happening on your watch. And so there's a collective responsibility to both do, train, support, motivate wherever each of us is on the continuum of action or the continuum of the movement. We've got to be able to cultivate that synergy for everyone, because everybody isn't a frontliner, and never was that case. But the stress and the strain and the long-term internal effects of doing or not doing are magnanimous, for lack of a better term. I mean, it is the term. It's huge. And so we've got to be able to think about how we take care of ourselves in the process of eliciting change and doing what has to be done.
Mm-hmm. I think about Eric Garner's daughter, who very much became an activist and advocate after his death. And then she recently passed herself so young. And I think it really brings to the fore how not only important this work is, but how this work really impacts us mentally and physically. And sometimes I think about not knowing all the details of like her health, but think about the people that I see going out there day in and day out fighting the fight, just the level of responsibility they have, and they're passionate about this work, and they do it because they're passionate about it. I mean, when I think about my boss, Mark Morial, when I think about some of my colleagues, even myself, but there definitely is an element to it where it can be burdensome. When I think about Eric Garner's daughter, I wonder if things could have been done a little differently in terms of maybe like her mental health or her self-care or her wellness, would she still be here today? And I think a lot of I think that in some cases inspired this episode, because I know that there are so many great people out there doing this work, and often at the detriment of their own sanity and their own mental health. So that brings me to my next question. A lot of us can feel mentally fatigued sometimes or feel a little burnt out at times. I think personally speaking, I can't even be on social media anymore, not only just like Twitter, because I really use Twitter for news, but even my own personal, for instance, Facebook page, just being inundated with just so much information. Everyone is talking about just the political climate, what's happening in Washington, what's happening at the borders, what's just happening across the country. But is there a distinction between being burnt out and mental fatigue, and how do we avoid checking out? Because for some of us, it's, well, I'm just going to check out for a little while. Is that okay? Is that a form of self-preservation?
Well, we all can only do as much as we can do. In your example about Eric Garner's daughter, that's a perfect illustration of the long-term harmful effects of social injustice, of significant trauma and grief. And it has shown all of us really what the downstream effects can be of having your father murdered and then not getting any justice for it. And it begs the question of what is the real fight here in terms of, it illustrates that our overall wellness and ability to thrive is under attack. Because if I dismantle your ability to be, if I disempower an entire generation, community of folks, an entire racial or ethnic group, if I set the tone that I can do and not be held accountable for, you cannot simply be and be allowed to live, then when you try to fight that fight while still grieving and not potentially having the level of the time to get the level of support to heal, it will in fact kill you. And there are many people who are still alive but not able to thrive any longer. So it's sort of walking dead, because when I don't have my consciousness anymore, that's what we're looking at with so many of our young Black men. When you watch your friends murdered in front of you, when your schools are not there to see you succeed, when people repeatedly let you know that there's a place for you and it's not among the free and the brave, then you are then very likely to become muted, to become withdrawn, to become dejected or outright enraged. Either way, you're constantly in a state of risk and not well-being. And so that brings us back to your everyday working person who is also battling that. Either I'm going to be completely withdrawn or enraged, neither of which is going to serve me well long-term. Mm-hmm. I'm out of balance, and what can I do to bring myself back to center and be able to function in a way that is effective? And so a big piece of this is going back to who am I and what do I really believe and what is my level of consciousness and awareness around what's going on, what my role in it has been, and what it will continue to be, or how I can make some shifts to be, again, maximally effective. And for people in the talented 10th, for people who are, have been privileged to be middle class over the years and have access to a number of resources, it does call into question some of those beliefs around the things that we've considered to be better. We discuss even still like better schools and better communities. And that begs the question, what makes it better? Better for who? When you believe things are better because people who don't look like us live there, because people who don't look like us send their children there, or your parents sent you there, and then you come out and you realize that neither money nor access to power and privilege will equalize this civil rights fight. And what's happening on Capitol Hill and what's happening at the White House is no respecter of persons in terms of our racial and gender and, you know, overall sexual orientation. All of the areas of diversity that are under attack do not really discriminate, you know, in jest. Just there's no discrimination among us in terms of where we were before and the false levels of privilege that we thought we had. So then we have to be forced to once again figure out how we're going to simultaneously take care of ourselves, find the skills to empower ourselves to act, and really walk in the responsibility of the one thing that our privilege has given us is the responsibility to go back and fetch that which is ours, which is our community. So have our very own Sankofa moments around going back and getting our folks, going back and getting that which is right, that which is necessary, and essentially coming outside of ourselves and realizing the truth in I am because we are. And that's heavy.
In D.C., and I'm sure this happens in many metropolitan areas, many of us turn to happy hour and drinks to decompress. So to keep it real, how do we avoid developing a substance addiction to combat some of the stress that we may be feeling? It's not, I think, an intentional. I don't think any addiction really starts intentionally. It's had a long day, 45 tweeted something again, another policy has been struck down. And at the end of a long day doing the work that you're doing, you're like, let me crack open this bottle of wine or let me go to this happy hour. And then before you know it, that's a coping mechanism. How do you avoid that?
So that is a really interesting question, because the first thing that came up for me was alignment. So everything has to be in alignment with progress and the movement. There is no real sort of zigzag in a movement. It's got to be clear and direct, and we are trying to clear the path. So again, that kind of dissonance comes up that I talked about before, the cognitive dissonance, because I will leave working on the movement towards elevating the current state of being for oppressed people and go to a Republican-owned establishment, perhaps, and pay three times or five times what something is worth to quote unquote, get better or decompress or feel better. And so when we really ask ourselves, well, what am I doing here? Because if this isn't in alignment with sowing into the community, into buying Black, banking Black, or whatever one's beliefs are around supporting people who support you, we've already sort of lost the fight. So that's really the reality of where we are, that everything has to be toward our ultimate goal and task. And that doesn't mean you cannot decompress, but decompressing can look like going to help some of these children in tutoring programs after school. Decompressing can look like having a really cool book club that's a distraction and it's about sort of positivity and what people like us have done over the years toward self-care. Decompressing could look like, you know, going and creating communities of support of like-minded people who don't talk about work or any of the stress in that time frame, but decompressing while doing something that causes us to be off our game and perhaps causes us to sow our dollars and our, you know, patronage into places and people who don't support us is quasi movement.
But keep it real, Charlene. Like here in DC, you have a lot of organizations that have like after hour events. Like I go to after hour events for particular causes, right? So attending that event could be toward support of like a scholarship fund or toward the support of some of the things that you named, because these things don't happen without money, without support, without some sort of advocacy. And before you know it,
we're 3 drinks in. I got
right.
you.
Like you're 3, you're 4 drinks in. And, you know, and then if you're doing this a couple of nights a week, right? Or even if you're doing it once a week, before you may even realize you've kind of, you know, developed this habit of drinking to relieve stress. And so that's kind of like what I'm getting at. Like how do we make sure that we're not turning to these things in order to de-stress and to decompress? Because I think a lot of people, particularly in and around the Beltway, I think a lot of people do that.
Well said. I totally agree and understand. And all I can say is that we have to maintain our awareness. Mm-hmm. It's totally cool to sometimes just let go and do what you want to do, even if, as you said, it's, you know, for the people and mm-hmm. you're at a social event that is, you know, even a gala. So the cocktail hour prior to this yeah. gala that's going to do some amazing things for the community. Being sure to keep our finger on the pulse of what's happening with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's even been affirmed on TV shows, you know, Olivia Pope and her glass of red wine, and then right. it turned into a bottle of red wine every single day,
right.
every single time you come home, and so on. And so really just not losing awareness and being sure to put some limits on anything that may be toxic to our overall wellness. And if, in fact, one finds that they are turning to alcohol or anything that would just not be safe for your overall well-being, again, I would encourage everyone to consider sitting down and talking to someone, begin to kind of track those things, begin to put some limits around how we engage in those sorts of social outlets to say, okay, tonight, guys, you know, keep your accountability partner, mm-hmm. make it fun and a collective thing. Y'all, we're only having 2 drinks tonight. That's it. And that's all, because we don't want to continue to perpetuate anything that could become addictive and unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. For those who are uncomfortable with the idea of therapy, you know, there are some stigmas around therapy. How do we get past that? Are there any programs or groups that they should consider, formal or informal, if they're feeling overwhelmed by the idea of therapy?
Certainly. So the first stigma is just around discussing mental health as mental illness, thinking that the two terms are synonymous and that therapy is for people who have XYZ disorder. And that is simply not the case. It is, as I said before, an act of wellness. However, if in fact one is still uncomfortable, I would suggest people consider researching treatment modalities or options for therapy and what it looks like. There's the National Association for Mental Illness. There's the Association of Black Psychologists. And you can really look and understand what undergirds the therapeutic process. What does it look like? What does it feel like? You can have a consultation with someone. You can consider groups. You can consider individual, family. There's multiple types of treatment modalities and a number of different types of therapists. The best thing I would suggest is that people really consider the who. It does matter, mm-hmm. as in most fields and most relationships that we engage in, the who matters. It matters to me who my dentist is and how he approaches oral health. And so similarly speaking, finding like-minded mental health practitioners, and there are many, and again, I would point people to websites like the Association of Black Psychologists that have directories of people who practice liberation psychology. So this whole idea around advancing the cause, the effects of oppression over time, the effects and the stress of discrimination, and really being liberated in our thoughts about what it means to be people of color or people of African descent in this and what has been termed as mental illness in our communities, really being adaptive responses to maladaptive circumstances. Those sorts of things would bring me in. Finally, someone who gets it versus something where you feel like you have to explain who you are, why you're feeling what you're feeling. You're not exactly clear about the lens through which that practitioner is seeing you. And then the subsequent advice or support will really be colored by that.
Mm-hmm. I think you spoke to this earlier, but just to circle back a bit, can people achieve a level of therapy by becoming involved in political or social issues, you know, quote unquote, activate in their wokeness, or will that just exacerbate what they may be feeling in this contentious environment?
Certainly. Every person is unique in what it means for them to feel better, feel motivated, be aligned or balanced and overall well, right? So that comes back to who am I and what motivates me and makes me feel fulfilled? And so for one person or for a whole bunch of people, that could look like talking about how I feel. And for some others, that could only make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So for the doers who are saying it would make me feel worse to sit there and talk about it and wallow, they consider therapy some form of wallowing and not necessarily activating this recharge that's necessary, and they recharge by getting out and doing something, then absolutely do that. And if everything else in your life is showing you that that's working well because you're sleeping better, you're feeling better, you're smiling more, you're drinking less, and all of those things, then keep doing those things that feed your soul. Keep doing those things that only you can know are fulfilling to you.
Dr. Charlaine, where can people learn more about you and the work that you do?
People can learn more about my business, Community Wellness Ventures, at www.cwellnessv.com. And they can learn more about me at Dr. Charlaine on Instagram and Twitter, Dr. Charlaine HW is my Twitter handle. Check me out. Reach out to me. Ask any questions. I'd love to keep the conversation going and be supportive in any way that I can.
So we like to close each episode by asking our guests what their call to action is for the movement. So what is your call to action for the movement?
My call to action for the movement is to use my skills and gifts around mental health and wellness and being a psychologist to elevate what works in communities of color, particularly African American communities, in terms of developing results-driven strategies to improve the outcomes for our people in poverty. So centralizing the conversation around wellness, doing what we know needs to be done to create truly effective wraparound approaches to supporting people being well. That includes training other practitioners, employing people, providing opportunities for housing, providing opportunities for workforce development, holding other folks accountable to do this work and do it well in a way that we'll be able to measure and show over time how we can really empower our community, build upon those strengths, and centralize the importance of mental health and wellness.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For our affiliate spotlight, this week we want to recognize the Urban League of Louisiana for naming a new CEO. Judy Reese-Morse, a top official in former Mayor Mitch Landrieu's administration with a long history in politics in the nonprofit sector, will assume the helm of the Urban League of Louisiana later this month. Morse takes over from Erica McConduit, who announced her departure after 5 years in March. Morse worked closely with Mayor Landrieu for many years. She was his final chief administrative officer, serving from December until the inauguration of LaToya Cantrell as the new mayor in May. She previously served as a deputy mayor, the leader of his mayoral transition office, and his chief of staff during his years as lieutenant governor. Judy Reese-Morse brings many, many, many years of leadership and executive experience. To learn more about her and the work of the Louisiana Urban League, visit urbanleaguela.org. As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy teams here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.